Ugly Duckling Oboes is dedicated to the development of young oboe players. They provide quality handmade oboe reeds, private lessons, and high-quality oboe sales, rentals, and consignments. The oboes that they rent are conservatory mechanism oboes that include the left-hand F key and low B flat key. All are maintained by oboe-specific technicians. In-person lessons are available, as well as virtual lessons for students who live outside the geographic area or have transportation and scheduling challenges. They also offer online college audition coaching for high school juniors and seniors who plan to audition to be music majors. Visit uglyducklingoboes.com for more details on how you can set up yourself for success and sign up for their newsletter. That's uglyducklingoboes.com.
Consider buying your processed oboe and bassoon cane from those friendly folks over at Barton Cane. Processed with care and precision for your everyday reed-making needs. Take the pain and injury out of reed-making by letting Barton Cane do the hard, repetitive, boring stuff. Free up time for practicing, happy hours, hikes, baking, and spending time with friends and family. Barton Cane, here for you. Visit www.bartoncane.com.
Hi, I'm Galit Kaunitz.
And I'm Jackie Wilson. And you're listening to Double Reed Dish,
a podcast for oboists,
bassoonists,
and the people who love them.
So we're recording this a half hour later than we planned because we got on Zoom and just started catching up and have been chatting as girlfriends when we were supposed to be podcasting. But
and we both have a little bit of a cold, so excuse us as we wheeze our way.
I feel like my cold is over, but I have this cough that like won't leave, and I'm sure you can tell my voice is not totally back. My sinuses are clear finally, and I'm feeling fine. I went on a run this morning, so I feel like I'm healthy. But
So we're on spring break, obviously, and I went to school on Friday, so the last day before spring break, so that I could hear one of my students perform in piano studio class. And this was when my cold was first coming in. And I said hello to Michael Bunchman, our piano collaborative piano faculty. And he was like, well, Dr. Kaunitz is a baritone today. How's everyone doing? I was like, is it that obvious?
I started getting sick the week before spring break, and I had really lost my voice. Like, I don't know. Like, after I pass 35, like, every time I get sick, I lose my voice. It didn't
that
used
does
to happen
to you. Yeah.
But it does now. And so I was like really creaking. And my students were like, go home. Oh, my God. Like, why are you here? And I was like trying to push through because, you know how it is. Sometimes it's just less convenient or pardon me. Sometimes it's just more convenient to push through than to deal with the making up of stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But we are both feeling better now. We just sort of sound a little.
It's like that. You remember that episode of Friends where Phoebe has what she calls the sexy phlegm?
No.
And she like sings and she feels like she has a raspier, like cooler voice. And so she wants to stay sick as long as possible. And like Ross starts to get a cold and she's like licking the edge of his cup so that she doesn't lose her sexy phlegm. I think I'm remembering that right. If the listeners correct me if I'm remembering that wrong, but I'm pretty sure. There's one of the songs she sings, like, my stinky shoe, my stinky, stinky shoe.
Oh, that's hilarious. Okay, so what have you been doing over spring break?
Okay, listen, I don't want to turn this into the complaint hour.
I'm smiling because Grumpy Jackie is my favorite.
I know. Part of why we're so friends is because when I am like ranting, you like think it's hilarious. I don't know. I think back to our dish of the New Year's resolutions and like all the intentions we were setting. And listen, I set them with all the sincerity in the world. And I am someone who, when I set a goal, I tend to be very dedicated to it. Having said that, this semester has not been great for me. And when we think about like really tragic life events, like there are people who are dealing with like their house burning down or the death of loved ones. Like I'm not dealing with anything like that, thank God. Nothing hugely significant. But then when we think about the other end of the spectrum and like annoyances, like right smack dab in the middle of like substantial, legitimate things that are difficult and not fun to deal with, I feel like it started January 10th. And just as soon as I get done dealing with the other, it's like whack-a-mole. Like as soon as I get done dealing with one, the other pops up, the other pops up, the other pops up. And I'm just like that saying, like we plan and God laughs.
Oh, yeah.
And like every time I get done with one, I'm like, okay, I'm gonna reset these intentions. And like I redo my New Year's resolution spreadsheet. And I'm like, that's okay. We'll just start it at like February 18th. That's all right. February 18th can be like the first day of the
That's a
year.
lot of the year left.
It just feels like I can't, like all those like good plans and good intentions have been, not even that I've like procrastinated or whatever, but that they've been like taken from my hands and I'm getting really sick of it. So basically my spring break has been spent dealing with the latest mole that needed to be whacked.
Sorry.
And he is not totally whacked down into the hole, like his eyes are still peeking out. But he's far down enough that I had all these elaborate spring break plans of like, okay, I'm gonna leave this project for spring break because I'm gonna get it done there. And so, then this mole popped up and needed to be whacked. And so now that he's kind of back in the ground, I'm having to deal with those projects before spring break is hopefully over, so I'm not behind. But I need the universe to just chill out a little
That
bit.
is so funny.
And I'm sorry for being cryptic, but like you all don't need to hear the details. It's just like annoying crap. Just annoying, sometimes very expensive, inconvenient crap that I have had to deal with. But you know what? I'm not on the tragic end of the spectrum. There's a lot to be grateful for.
There's a lot to be grateful for.
Everything has been deal with a bowl. But the most recent thing, unfortunately, has postponed what I had wanted to be, what I had wanted to tell you when you ask, what are you doing spring break? Was to detail the plans of my 40th birthday party. And that is going to be postponed. And that's okay. We will get there. And at some point you'll ask, so what are you doing this weekend? And I'll say, oh, we're doing that thing that had to be postponed. But yeah, so basically I'm licking my wounds and pouting. That's what I'm doing.
Again, a worthy activity.
Absolutely, absolutely. What about you?
Yeah, I spent spring break recovering from a cold.
Yes.
You know how much I love to nap. I have been napping.
That's great. I'm so glad you've been napping.
It's been pretty calm, a pretty uneventful spring break, which I'm happy about. The weather has been beautiful. It's been like in the 60s and 70s. And a lot of porch time. I have trained two of my dogs to get up on the hammock with me. So it's
Oh.
the best. Like I'll sit in the middle of the hammock. Like I don't go lengthwise. I just sit in
Oh,
it.
okay.
And then they will hop up one on either side. And I'll have one arm on each butt.
So you just have porch puppy cuddles in the hammock.
That's right. That's right.
Oh my God, that sounds amazing. It hailed here yesterday.
It rains, it hails. Am I
When it
right?
rains, it hails. Yes. Chemical City Double Reeds is a full-service double reed shop specializing in the sale of instruments, cane, accessories, and sheet music. Double Reed Dish listeners can enjoy free shipping with code DRDISH, all caps, no spaces. Visit them in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, or online at chemicalcityreeds.com.
Hey, oboists! Have you ever found it difficult to sort out when and how to find a new oboe or English horn? Oboe Chicago streamlines the process, providing personal and professional consultation and a large selection of lovely instruments. The process feels comfortable and thorough. Selection includes F. Leray of Paris, Haworth of London, Covey Oboes, and Fox products. For a current listing of Oboe Chicago's selection, please visit www.obochicago.com. For a credit of $100 toward shipping, mention Double Reed Dish when you call or email Shauna.
We are so delighted to welcome to Double Reed Dish, friend of the podcast, Melissa Bosma, who teaches oboe at the University of Texas at Arlington. Melissa, welcome.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
We are so excited to chat with you for the next hour. And let's start off by having you tell us and our listeners how and when you started to play the oboe.
See, I started oboe in sixth grade. And unlike a lot of oboists, I started on oboe. I didn't start on another instrument. I picked it because my best friend wanted to play oboe and I wanted to do what she was doing. So we both became oboists. And for the most part, I am thrilled with my choice most days. When my reeds cooperate, I am thrilled that this was my choice.
Well, I love the solidarity. It's like, you know, let's do this together. I hope we both like it.
Right. She had more info. Her older brother was a bassoonist, so she knew what double reeds were. I thought it looked pretty. That was honestly my selling point. It was like, it looks like a pretty instrument. And my mom knew enough classical music, you know, like played Swan Lake for me. And was like, that's the oboe. And I'm like, what is the oboe? She's like, literally the only thing playing. And I was like, I don't know what the oboe is. So I was a lost cause early on, but I really enjoyed it. So I'm glad that she was making that choice and I ended up with the oboe.
Would you talk us through your training and educational journey and maybe what made you decide to be a professional musician?
Yeah. So I grew up in Texas and I had a private lesson teacher like my sixth grade year and then didn't have anything regularly until late in high school. And I was fortunate enough to study with Aaron Hannigan starting my sophomore year of high school.
Wow. And, what a huge advantage.
I know. I wish I had had her earlier on, but I was thrilled to have her when I did. And it only came about because another friend in high school who was a horn player was taking lessons with someone in the Dallas Symphony. And, you know, had talked to me, her mom had talked to my mom. My mom was like, you know, Melissa seems really into this. Let's see if there's a chance that there's someone in the DSO who would teach her. And fortunately, Erin had a spot in her studio. And I think it was after about a year of studying with her, she mentioned in a lesson, you know, if you're ever considering music as a career, let me know, because we'll, you know, intensify kind of what we're working on in your reed making. And I remember having this moment and saying, what do you mean music as a career, which should have dawned on me. Obviously, she played in the DSO and was a professional oboist, but realized at some performances in high school, kind of my junior year, that I love performing and that I love doing this and really wanted to go that route. I ended up staying with Aaron. I went to Southern Methodist University in Dallas for my undergrad in performance. And then I went to the University of Michigan and studied with Nancy Ambrose King for my master's in performance in chamber music after that.
So can you talk us through embarking on your professional journey and deciding that pedagogy or higher ed was what you wanted to pursue? I know that you were involved with the summer program, the Oboe Intensive at the University of Michigan. And I wonder if that was kind of formative in deciding that pedagogy was where you wanted to go. Can you tell us a little bit about the path out of school?
Absolutely. So actually, I've always known I wanted to teach in some capacity. Like even kind of starting undergrad, I knew that I love performing, but I love working with students. So even I'm so grateful to there was a band director my freshman year of undergrad who took a chance on me as a brand new private lesson teacher. So I taught all throughout undergrad. I think by my senior year, I had around 15 private students while still obviously being in school full time, and knew I wanted to continue that when I got to Michigan. And I was fortunate as a grad student that Dr. King, knew I wanted to teach and let me help with the it was called the Impulse Institute that was like 2 weeks long, intensive with a bunch of high school oboes. Usually we had 16 or 17 students. And it was great being a newer experience because it incorporated reed making and other things that I wasn't normally teaching. Obviously in private lessons with my little babies, with my middle school and fledgling high school students, that it was really nice to get that kind of added experience and have moments where she was able to watch me as I was teaching so I could get a lot of feedback. I also had a professor while I was at SMU, Dr. Sarah Allen, who is still a great friend and mentor to me, a member of our music education faculty, and was who taught pedagogy for me in undergrad and really helped spark that interest. A big part of our course, we had to have a private student that we recorded bits of lessons a few weeks in a row. And we would, I mean, show those clips in front of the class and kind of analyze our teaching. And that was the first time someone, was actually able to give direct feedback to what I was doing. And I took an independent study with her the next semester and kept kind of working on the pedagogy side of things. And it was nice because normally, your teachers ask about your lessons, but they don't usually get to directly witness what you're doing. And it was really great and sparked a definite interest in me.
Can you talk to us a little bit about some of the specifics that you worked on or feedback? I mean, I feel like I look back on my early teaching and it's like, whoa, yikes. And like sometimes even in studio class, you'll have a student teach one another and you really become aware of what a craft it is to teach effectively. And so I'm interested in kind of the pedagogy of pedagogy and what you all talked about in that experience.
Right. I don't remember what sophomore we or software we used, but I remember we had with some of our videos, we had a mix. It wasn't supposed to be all successful videos. So I remember having one that was, you work with a student and you never accomplish what it is you were trying to get them to accomplish. And it was really fun, I know, to watch everybody do that and all of us so frustrated with, not getting the right words out. But I know we used the software at one point and we had to mark, like when you gave a compliment, when you gave a critical comment, and kind of see like talking about compliment sandwiches and if that's good or bad. And I remember having questions where I had students that, you could be critical with, and I had some where I was like, literally every comment needs to be positive or the student's going to shut down. And that was really nice to open up kind of a conversation. I remember in class that, every student's different. And so, yes, I'd prefer you don't use, this compliment sandwich method. But if this student needs that, then that's totally fine. And kind of learning from that. And it was such a cool experience. And it was neat too. There was a wide range of instruments. And it was actually a grad level class. So all different students of different levels of teaching to see their videos and get feedback. And I think part of the class too, we had to teach someone in the class our instrument at the end too, and like have them try it. Which was really fun on someone that, obviously isn't a true beginner, like in the sixth grade sense. Like they're a musician enough to know how it should sound. But it was really eye-opening. And I had the chance last spring to teach pedagogy at UTA and incorporated some of the videos into the class. And it was really fun. And I mean, kind of exciting to see how cringy everyone felt watching themselves teach. But all of them seeing, what they learned, and especially, a student will play something and we'd be automatically want to say, oh, that's great. Or I had one student that'd say, perfect. And I paused the video. I said, was that perfect? And he said, no. And I said, okay, then what word would you rather use? If you could go back and fix it, kind of the framing it as you're not doing anything wrong, but how can you get the student to improve more?
I love that. If I could go back and ask you a follow-up question about your personal oboe education, you studied with two powerhouse female oboists and educators. Do you think that has like impacted your outlook on teaching and pedagogy and like your place in the world, like having those two amazing role models?
For sure. It definitely did. I think it wasn't until kind of years being out of school that I realized, I mean, I knew I was fortunate to stay with both of them and it was an amazing experience, but realizing how kind of rare it is to have two female teachers, that pretty much all of my oboe education has been under really strong women. And that's definitely been really formative in becoming, you know, a professional musician and in my teaching. But it helps that they're both such amazing players and pedagogues and wonderful people that I know for Dr. King, kind of seeing that as a woman in music, you can do everything. You can, you know, be the president of IDRS. You can be a full professor. You can have kids. You can run a marathon in all 50 states. She's
amazing. Like she runs a marathon every day.
It really is. It's I remember staying with her and saying, like, you know, I wish I was in the shape she was in, you know, as her student, but to be such a positive role model in so many ways and realize that you don't have to sacrifice to be successful and that you can still be, you know, a great person and bubbly and wonderful and positive, and that you don't have to let kind of the state of the world or things in music in general get you down.
Mm-hmm. That's really inspiring. I don't know how she does all this. She does.
I don't either. I still don't have it figured out, but she's incredible.
Yeah.
Well, she did tell us that she taught her sons how to gouge cane and told them it was a game. So that's yes,
She does have some assistance, and I do envy any cane processing assistance that exists out there. But still, I swear her days have a few more hours built in than the rest of ours do. Like,
I just love that. Let's play cane games, kids.
And I tried to get my undergrad roommates to help with stuff, and they're like, no, we know what you're doing. And they just wanted to gouge. And I was like, no, you can split and do the early stuff, but you're not touching my gouger. And they weren't
That's
into
right.
that.
So that's we right. talked about kind of your initial training as a pedagogue. Can we hear a little bit about your current position and how you approach that?
Absolutely. Right now at UTA, I'll admit the studio is a little on the smaller side, so it's more manageable in terms of quantity of students that are at different levels. But right now I have two majors right now and a non-major taking lessons. So the two majors are in studio class, and one is a grad student, and one's a freshman. So it's a really interesting kind of spread of things. And the freshman used to study with the grad student. So it's everyone's comfortable with everybody, which is great in learning. So I have that. We don't have a separate read class for us. So we just have studio for an hour once a week on Mondays. And it's very much a mix of kind of learning to use all of the read tools, mix of performing. So the grad student may be doing excerpts when the freshman's playing a Barrett etude, and getting feedback. And they're both really, I'm fortunate, they're both really great at their comments that they give that are really constructive and positive and, you know, lending themselves to more feedback. It's not just, you know, the, I like your tone or your vibrato's nice, like actually kind of pulling something out of them, which is great. I also, most semesters I coach woodwind chamber music and teach music appreciation as well. Mm-hmm. So I'm balancing that. And then outside of UTA, I'm in three different school districts where I teach. I have about 40 students in grades 6 through 12. And quite a few of them, I make reads for them as well. So it's definitely a lot. But like you said, Texas is its own thing. I mean, one of my middle schools has 10 oboists. Like, you won't find that anywhere else.
Wow.
Okay.
It's like, take a minute to process.
I gotta get over the shock for a second. You make reads for 40 students that you see every week?
Not all of them, and not usually there's a mix. Some of my students are completely on my reads, and then some of them it's a mix of store-bought and mine because I have to maintain some level of sanity, and there's only so many reads I can make a week.
So would you say you sell about 20 reads a week?
Some weeks. My
Okay.
middle schoolers also have perfected the art of hoarding reads and making them last far longer than a read should last. So I probably should be selling 20 a week, but because they hold on to them, it ends up kind of staggered every few weeks.
I am very familiar with this particular skill set. It's fine. I'm like, how old is it? They're like, don't worry about it. I'm like, no, how old
Right.
is
Yeah, I had during at
it?
UTA, we have in the fall an Allstate Day, and one of our guest artists who we brought in was talking about, saving older reads for, if the weather changes or just having something comfortable. And I paused him and said, "How old is an old reed?" And all the oboists, like the high school oboists, started snickering when he was like, "Oh, like 2 weeks old." And I was like, "See," he was like, "Why did you ask that?" I was like, "Ask some of them how old their reeds
They're like, I only bought this one 8 months ago.
That's why I use a different thread color each month so that I can keep track of it. Like, I'll be like, "That's a Valentine's read from last year. We need to have a conversation."
Okay, though, that's a brilliant strategy.
That
Because it
is.
fulfills, it scratches the itch of wanting to have way more thread than I need, and it keeps my students accountable, so it works out.
You go into your spreadsheet and you're like, lavender was 6 months ago, so I'm going to need you to lock it up.
Right. Usually it's the months with big holidays. I'm like, okay, that's 4th of July colored, or like that's Christmas colored. Like, how long have you had that Christmas wreath?
You share with us some strategies, some tips and tricks on managing such a massive private studio?
Yeah.
Yes. What has helped considerably, there is this lovely, wonderful website called My Music Staff
I love it.
where, yes,
I
it
just
changed the
started it
game.
and I love it. And I don't have 40, I have seven.
What
Yes,
is
but it
it?
makes a
My
huge
music
difference.
staff?
Yes.
Yes.
And it allows you to do billing because otherwise, I'd be
Yes.
there with like my notebook writing down like who got a read and who does this. And you
Oh.
import all the lessons. You can, if someone moves days, you can just drag it over and it takes attendance. You can put lesson notes in it. I don't, but just because some of my schools are like bunkers and I, despite Wi-Fi, data, anything, can't get any service. So I still have a notebook where I write down what they're doing in their lesson each week. And like if they bought a read, if they need a read, so that kind of at the end of the week, I take inventory, like how many reads do I need to make this week? What am I working with? And taking notes of all of that. But it has, yes, you pay a monthly fee for using the website, but it has changed the game for me with billing and making it so much easier.
And I think the monthly fee is $15.
Yeah,
So
it's
even
not
if you
bad.
teach like one student an hour lesson of a week, it pays for itself.
Yeah, it's way more convenient, and I think this is the first, last year was the first full year I used it, so I'm hoping like as I do taxes and things that it'll be easier because all of my income from private teaching is logged into that website.
1,000%.
Wow. I guess similarly, can we talk a little bit about reads? So I'd love to hear about your, read setup and your read approach. But yeah, even a fraction of 40 plus students is a lot. And so that seems like also a time management aspect you'd have to consider. And then also, I assume they're not all playing. Maybe I'm assuming wrongly, but that a middle school read isn't kind of the same as what you need professionally. So I know it's a multi-part question, but yeah, talk us through that part of your professional life. Holy moly.
Yeah, it means that usually I don't have many reads for me at the present moment. I've had a lot of mouths to feed read-wise after holiday break. And especially we had kind of a crazy cold snap, so reads have been, January reads are fun in Texas. But yeah, I would say my, obviously a sixth grade read is going to be scraped down a lot more and a lot more vibrant than something I would play on. But I just, for me, part of it is I think back to, it's so embarrassing now to think through it, but obviously in middle school, I didn't have a teacher. So I remember ordering reeds in seventh and eighth grade and being like, these don't work. Like, we need to send them back. And, you know, the companies are like, you absolutely can't send back reeds. Like, that's a sanitary thing. You bought it. I'm like, well, they don't play. And now I'm like, oh my gosh, I didn't know. Like, the understanding is that someone needs to adjust them and make them work for you. Mm-hmm. But obviously,
well, how would you know? How would
you
know
I didn't
if
know
you don't
that.
Know?
I want to like go back and like write that person and be like, I'm sorry that however many years ago it's been now that I was like this, seemed like this brat trying to return reads.
But also it is an access issue that for the people who want to play oboe who do not have those resources, you know, that is a big barrier.
Absolutely. And I've told students too, especially I have some that don't play on mine at all. And eventually their band directors kind of nudge them to use mine. And some that use a mix. So, you know, they'll ask me like, should I be on medium soft or should I be on medium? I'm like, the harder you go, the more that I'm going to need to adjust it. Like, you're going to get it and you're going to feel like you're like, it's what like Aaron used to refer to my reeds when I first started making them as hernia reeds, that they're just too hard. She was always like, you're going to hurt yourself. Like, I know you want your reed to quote unquote be dark, but there is a better way to get this to happen and do it. And it's definitely a challenge. And, but I enjoy it. Like for me with my students, I could be making reeds and I'll feel one and kind of be like, oh, like I know which student this would feel really good on because I've made enough reeds for them. I know what they need their reeds to feel like. So they always ask, I'm like, is yours medium soft? I'm like, this reed is yours. It is made for you. It's not a specific hardness that I would assign to it. But I use, unlike a lot of reed makers, I use all of my same stuff that I make for my reeds, because if a
I
reed
was just
turns
gonna
out
ask,
really
sorry
good,
to interrupt you. Yeah.
Yeah. Because if a reed turns out great, I don't want to be like, oh, this is on a cork that doesn't work great, or oh, it's this that I found that just didn't work for me. So I use, you know, the same staples for my reeds as I do for students, same gouge. And
so that
shape.
If it's really good, you can just be like, oh, I'm keeping this for me.
Yes.
Yes.
Like I have a few really strong high school students and they know, like, if I have a performance coming up, like I'll play it and they'll look at me. They're like, if you need to keep that, it's okay.
That's
or if I
so
give it to
generous.
Them, I tell them, I'm like, you need to really appreciate this because I love this reed right now. So I do not want to hear any reed slander about this one because then I'm keeping it.
Yeah, that was actually going to be my follow-up question, because I know that a lot of people use like different staples and different gouge and, you know, just to try to speed up the process or, you know, increase return on investment because it is expensive to make reeds.
Yes, it definitely is. And I've tried some of the cheaper staples and especially the synthetic cork, just because honestly, it goes in and out of their oboes easier and they destroy the corks less. But I haven't found any that for me have been really reliable opening wise in length, that a lot of them have been so open that they make massive reeds. And the last thing I want to do is give any of those young oboists a reed that has one dynamic and it's fortissimo. Like, it's not going to help any of what we're working on.
Have you, like, do you hand make all of them or do you profile?
I hand make. I don't have a profiler.
So do you have to do anything proactively to like keep your hands healthy?
What I try to do is I'll do them in batches. So I, like I said, it's not always like every week a ton of reads. I did have right before Christmas break where I was definitely a little sore and tender because I had so many students need reads that it was ridiculous. But that I'll, you know, tie maybe like 9 or 12 or something. And then I might not honestly tie any for the next week. And then the next week do a batch that I'll try to space it out. And I, as best as I can, try to space out kind of scraping on the reeds over several days so that it's not just like hand cramping and doing everything all at once.
Can we hear your specs, like the shape you use, the gouger you like to use, all that good stuff?
Absolutely. I have two gougers. One, I think honestly, both are due for a new blade. I'm going to use UTA's machine a little bit. and I want to make sure that it's all still working well. But I have a Ross gouge and a Cooney Bear. I've been using the Cooney Bear lately just because that blade is happier right now. My shape is a Mac Plus. And then I believe my staples are RDG type 1 right now.
Oh, I well, now I want to try those.
Well,
say
you
I
should,
like
because this
them.
podcast is sponsored by IDG RDG Woodwith, bringing you this episode in part.
I love it. And I love that they have like a percentage discount when you bulk order staples, which obviously I'm doing. So it's also nice.
Okay. I would love to know about your favorite repertoire that you like to assign your students. Do you have any like hidden gems that we need to know about, especially for pedagogical reasons?
I'm trying to think hidden gems. It's interesting right now, especially because my grad student at UTA loves new music. So she's usually the one coming to me. She's making playlists all the time on Spotify and finding new stuff. So she's usually coming to me with rep I don't know and I'm checking out, which is really fun. That she's always finding whatever is new. What was her one? It's not even, I don't think, a hidden gem anymore, but the poem, I think it's Dronishnikova or
Oh, the Dronishnikova.
that, yes.
That's fantastic.
Yes, it's so good. That was one that she was like, I really want to play this and played it for me. Yes, this is fantastic. My students are all rightfully so going through a phase. They're obsessed with Alissa Morris's music. And again, rightfully so. I love her and I love her stuff. So they're always asking to play pieces by her. And I find that we're doing more, and as we should be, having more even representation of music. That yes, we still learn the Mozart, we still, learn our standards, but incorporating some more of less represented composers, whether that's gender or ethnicity, that those pieces need to be played. And there are pieces that easily I feel like can swap out or be different than what are standards. And so I love that students are open to that too and are recognizing it and wanting to play new rep.
So you are one of the few people. I mean, there are many people who have done this, but I guess I should say one of the few double reed professors, probably one annually at most, gets to present at the Midwest Clinic. The proposal process is more elaborate than your average conference. It's super competitive. And then the experience, I would guess, is just also very different from your average conference. Can we hear about your Midwest experience?
Yes. It was so much fun. What's actually funny about it is that the I guess the previous year or calendar year I presented at TMEA, so at Texas Allstate, did the same presentation at both. And TMEA actually has more people I think attend than Midwest, which
Oh,
is
wow. Well,
because
tell us
Texas
about
is
both then.
bonkers. Texas is bananas with it. But I'm trying to remember because it's been a few years, but both times, I mean, an absolutely incredible experience. For me, a particular passion and is making sure that young oboists really get, solid fundamentals and a good start. There's so much that I wish I had known before, Aaron had to be like, why aren't you using this key? Like, why don't you know what this exists? Why are you doing this fingering? That it's like, I wish I had known this. I wish I had, some embouchure corrections earlier on. So the whole premise of my clinic was, I think it was How to Start Strong and Sound Great on the Oboe was the name of it, and went over, up to advanced things like vibrato, but a lot of it was, with how to select reeds, how to look at them and know if it has a shot at actually sounding good, and how to support your students. And it was really encouraging at both conferences to basically speak to a packed, ballroom that a lot of band directors really do want to learn and do the best that they can for their students. Because as we know, there are very few double reed directors out there. I don't know how that works out that way, but we don't interact with a ton of them. And it was great. The proposal process, I'm trying to remember, it was slightly different for both. I know for Midwest, you had to have presented at a previous conference somewhere and have some feedback on your presentation there, like have someone write a recommendation who had seen it to give feedback. I believe for TMEA, I think I had a Word document or something that like outlined all of what I was kind of bullet points of what I was going to cover in all of it, and kind of who your audience is and all of that. But I don't believe I needed any like recommendations or references for it. But not too crazy. I just remember thinking like, well, I haven't made the whole presentation yet, so I have to think like, I don't want to not mention something like there, because they don't want you just to like say, yeah, I'm talking about this, and then go off script and totally not be doing what they're, you know, approving you to do. But I remember just sitting and going through a lot of it and figuring out, you know, asking my students too, what do you wish you knew when, you know, you were coming up and first learning the oboe? What do you wish someone had told you? How do you wish someone had encouraged you? And incorporating that, I had some, you know, like embouchure pictures where I used my students as guinea pigs to take pictures of, you know, good embouchure, or here's what it looks like when you have air trapped here, or doing these different things, because I wanted them to be kind of part of the experience, because I was, you know, picking their brains as well. But it was honestly, presenting at both of those conferences was probably the highlight of what I've done in higher ed, and getting really positive feedback from it. And even getting directors that said, hey, can you send us your PowerPoint, because we want to have it as a resource, or, you know, you had these slides about how to like do baby adjustments to store-bought reads. Can you send that to us? Like, it was really good. And I would love to come up with something new and present something else that it was really fun speaking to all the directors about it.
Oh, that's so cool. So you are probably, I would guess, from your career trajectory and growing up in an area, in a highly competitive area, going on and having a whole career and then coming back home, I would guess that you probably have a lot of good advice about networking and creating relationships and maintaining relationships in music. So I'd love to ask you your advice on that.
Absolutely. Part of it was interesting when I moved back into the DFW area was fall of 2019. So we all know how 2020 went. So it was very interesting in that I felt like I was just getting settled and, you know, ready to reach out to ensembles and say, you know, I'm back in the area, sending my resume, and then everything shut down. So it's been kind of interesting redeveloping it. But I think one piece of advice that I would give, and I would give to my younger self too, is to not be afraid to ask for help. Part of how I got settled in the area was sending messages and asking people like, do you know what districts need a teacher? Do you know, like, is there need? Should I even be coming back to DFW? And there's a lot of need. It's just such a big area that you don't want to just plop down and hope for the best on where you're going to be. And it was really nice that several people were really helpful in kind of telling me what parts of town were needing a teacher. And just one, to obviously ask for help and know that you have more of a network than you think you do. It was during kind of that process and where I was in my career, both of you included, I remember, reached out to me and were really supportive, that kind of realizing that we do all have a support system and kind of this army of double reed players that are ready to, you know, prop us up at any moment, that's out there. And so even if you feel like you don't, that there are plenty of people who want the best for you and are going to help get you set up. And don't be afraid to just reach out to people. I know I've had people ask me like, how did you get this masterclass clinician, or how did you get this? I'm like, I emailed and asked if they wanted to trade masterclasses, or if they want, then I have to remind myself the worst thing that's going to happen is either they don't respond or they say no. And if they do, no harm, no foul, like keep moving on. That we have enough rejection in this field that if I hear no, just for like a class or something, it's not gonna, I'm not gonna like crawl into like a hole for a day or two. Like, I'm like, okay, next, we're gonna keep
yeah,
moving
there are
on.
Way bigger things to be upset about.
Yes, I realized in the grand scheme of things, someone saying like no, or I don't have time. But, and I was warned early on in my career with asking people, they're like, you know, there are people who already have tenure and they're probably not going to want to come out or do a free class. And in my experience, honestly, everybody has said yes, because they've been really nice and really supportive. Just sometimes scheduling doesn't work. So doing that in trusting in yourself. I know it was hard early on for me, actually, when I taught in Michigan, because I was determined to have a private studio, and there wasn't that culture of private lessons like Texas has, that it's just built in. You go to the school, you know, the school sets the rate, they, you know, can provide scholarships. That these band directors were like, well, you need to make a flyer and we'll put it in the band hall. I was like, can you not just tell your oboe students that they need to take lessons? And I resisted it for a while. And so I'm like, okay, no, I'm going to play the game, and made the flyer and, you know, made a website, did all the things, and all of a sudden got students, and then reached out to some directors and said, hey, do you ever need someone to do master classes? And they're like, well, we haven't really done this, but that would be great. But like piecing together things, that just to believe in yourself, because it's so easy to get kind of worn down and to, you know, not be positive, that we're not always our best kind of cheerleaders and supporters of ourselves and what we do, and just to go for it. And again, the worst thing someone's going to say is no. But even if you're in a state or in a town where maybe a private lesson program doesn't exist, try something and see if it sticks. I realized, you know, in the summer students weren't taking lessons, and it gets to be kind of tough times financially. And when I was in Michigan, I decided to create a double read camp. And a lot of them were my students, but I had other people's students come to me, and we did a week of a few hours a day just learning some basic read making. And I learned a lot with teaching read making. They got to meet other students and kind of have a good time forming an oboe community, especially because a lot of the schools only had one or two oboists. It was really exciting for them to meet other people. And it was super fun. And I mean, I don't know that any of them, you know, grew up to be professional oboists and study it, but they had a great time and they learned some basic adjustments, which, you know, as a teacher also makes my life easier, that the less read crises, the better. But it's stuff like that, that if you have an idea, even if it seems crazy or, you know, not manageable, start working through it, write it out and see. And if you want to collaborate with someone else who you think's crazy enough to buy into it with you, so you have a partner in it, do it, but don't try not to be intimidated by it, and know that it, with some people, it may take two or three emails before you finally get that response, but to like really go for it.
Kind of related to some of what you've been talking about, I remember it was several years ago now, and you gave me some really good advice. I was kind of in the throes of not knowing how to deal with the nervous sensations that come along with performing. And I remember saying like, oh, I tend to like to dress down as much as possible, as much as professional and appropriate for any given opportunity, because I feel like, you know, like heels or fancy dresses or whatever, it just amps up the situation that much more. And it overwhelms me. And I remember you said, oh, that's funny. I feel the exact opposite. I feel like when I get dressed up, I feel like Superman putting on his cape. And yeah. it was great advice. It's never left me. And I wonder if we could hear some of your thoughts, experiences, or tips or tricks for dealing with performance anxiety.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm one that if I'm like not feeling great or not having a good day, that like if I spend that extra effort, like I do my hair or dress a little nicer, it like picks me up. There are plenty of days that I don't. I'm sure my students can tell you all about the days where they're like, ooh, she is struggling this morning. but I do like kind of the aspect of occasionally dressing up. And just for me, I feel I like switch into performance mode. It's like, okay, this is something like real happening. For me, my biggest thing to combat performance anxiety is honestly like feeling 100% prepared, that I have practiced a ton. My biggest thing is usually the week before a recital. I think this came from Aaron. I always try to remember which teacher gave me this nugget. But to practice, like go through my recital program 3 times in a row, back to back to back, which is painful and awful in every way. But for me, it almost like helps out my brain. Like I know it doesn't change the nerves, but when, you know, you start playing and my face feels super exhausted, because that's what happens when we're nervous, that I can like out logic it. That I'm like, you've been doing this 3 times in a row. You can do this once. Like your face is fine. Like shh, brain, like stop doing it. Doing that. So doing that, like I know before auditions, the more I played in front of people, played in front of other musicians, like not necessarily oboists, but getting feedback also from other people, helped. But for me, it's just honestly running the program and doing it over and over. Obviously, having reeds that are feeling good helps a lot too. Because even if I know I can play the program, if my reeds have not been great, it's not a good feeling. But yeah, for me, that was one thing. That was a big change for me, kind of focusing on oboe. I feel like now it's in a past life, but as young me was a competitive figure skater, and I always struggled with that you could practice and practice, and like you'd still fall on things, and like you wouldn't feel like 100% ready. And then I'd practice oboe, and I was like, well, like when I practice and I get this, like I don't feel the same nerves. I don't feel this out of body kind of crazy nervous experience. Like I feel like I'm prepared and it's going to be good. And I was like, this is different. I like this feeling that like I'm in control, which I should have felt still with skating, but I enjoyed that more with oboe. So that's been something that's really important for me. But for me also, I mean, I do a lot of like, we'll do, I learned from a yoga class I took in my master's. It was yoga for performers. Like, and the biggest thing I got from that was a lot of like more deep breathing and kind of how to calm my heart rate and kind of, breathing it, taking longer to exhale than inhaling. I know a lot of us have like smartwatches that have breathing exercises now, and it's kind of the same concept, when I'm feeling kind of that tension. But for me, like I like before a performance, I have some form of pop music going through my headphones, and I'm just like rocking out. I'm like, okay, let's go do this. It's gonna be fun.
I love that. Would you share with us a favorite memory from a past performance?
I think honestly, what was really neat, my last faculty recital when I did last year, I finished with Kelly Vaineman's play for solo oboe and audience. I don't know if you're familiar with it. But each movement, so it incorporates the audience. So there's one movement, like they clap along with you. There's one that they sing different pitches, like switch between two notes to create the harmony as you play. And then the other one, they stomp. They do like the we will rock you, the stomp, stomp, clap. And it was so much fun. And I was honestly really concerned that the singing one, that they would totally not do it and that this was going to fall flat. And they rocked out with it. It was really, really fun and was so interactive. And it was just really neat to incorporate the audience in a way and have a fun closer that I enjoyed it. And I would love to play, like, I think I'll do little snippets of it if I ever am, playing elsewhere or doing things because it's just such a fun experience.
Oh my God, I love that. It's cool. What advice do you have for a young musician who aspires to have a career like yours?
I would say go make reeds. More than
I don't know
anything,
where I've
go.
heard that before.
Yeah. Yeah, go and make reeds. Oh my gosh. For the longest time, my reeds were awful, and I know really limited me in a lot of ways. And I think Erin has even changed some ways of like when she gives students reeds or how long she does it, because I definitely took advantage of that situation for a while. So I know she's always surprised when, like, obviously I'm teaching a lot and selling a bunch of reeds that I finally figured it out, Erin. I got it. Like, so it's manageable. We're working. But I think one, making a lot of reeds and practicing a lot, but just to always, no matter what you're going through, like still find your joy in music. I think so many students, and I know, I think Galit, you posted something about this that I like reshared about like that rule of thirds, that like a third of your practice sessions are going to feel super great and wonderful, and a third are okay, and a third are just awful. That I think so many students feel like, if they're in the awful one, that they have to stay in that. And like, you know what, if you're having a bad day and what makes you happy is pulling out like this old piece that you played or this other concerto, pull that out. Like do what you need to get out of a funk. And again, have people that support you and that you can talk to when you have those days that you're like, why am I doing this? What is happening? Like, I feel like I'm not improving. And have those people and keep them close to you, because with any field, the grass isn't greener doing anything else. But what we do is definitely unique in that it is so individual based that I think having a great support system and just constantly like pushing yourself, but remembering why you do it is the most important. Because otherwise, if you don't love what you're doing, it's going to come across in your playing and in your teaching. And you don't want that.
Melissa, this has been such a wonderful, fortifying conversation. Thank you so much for so generously spending your time with us today.
Thank you for having me. This has been so much fun.
We hope you enjoy that episode and that you will join us for the next episode and run on sentence, that you will follow on social media, rate and review on iTunes, all that good stuff. We have an awesome episode and interview coming up next time. Galit, who's it going to be with?
We had such a wonderful conversation with Margaret Cookhorn, who is the principal contrabassoon and bassoon with the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra. Jackie, let's end this nerd parade.
So may creed.